All right, so what I want to do starting tomorrow is try to walk through sort of a higher level picture of how you might structure a system around the kinds of primitives that we spent the first half or two-thirds of the semester talking about. I'm going to start this today, and I concluded that I want to take yet another diversion for a current discussion. But before I do that, I also want to ask people if there are questions about things in the midterm following the discussion from last week. All right. I'm actually pretty happy with the midterm results. Really, the only places were, and I've sent out the grades. Has anybody not received their grade? I'm very happy to provide, you know, individual scores question by question, but sending out the summary was the thing I could do fast. And really, the only places where anybody missed any substantial number of points were places where they simply didn't answer a question. So I was actually very, very happy with those results. I want to digress a little bit to talk about something that's not really a microkernel topic per se, but it seems to be sort of related to microkernel issues, and the reason is that nobody seems to be able to know how to make it work with a monolithic kernel. And that is this issue of TCPA and TPM or TCG or ENGSCUB, you know, whatever your latest acronym of the week is. And what I want to focus on here is not ENGSCUB, which is what the Microsoft Palladium thing turned into. But the underlying hardware that's being deployed in the PC world and what it enables and what one might do with it. The current focus of attention for this hardware is primarily on digital rights management, or at least that was the initial public story. If you actually look at how this stuff is getting used today, it turns out that the digital rights management stuff was just too hard. And most of what these chips are being used for is local encryption. There's an interesting balancing act going on in these chips, and it's... So what I want to walk through is how the mechanism works, how one might... what one might do with it, and how it actually does what it does, for that matter, talk about what it does. And also talk about what's the balance of power that's changing in the design of computational systems, and what kinds of things can be done with that. There's a sort of strongly felt battle going on about digital rights management and whether DRM is a good thing or a bad thing, and whether people should have the right to copy bits. And I don't think that DRM is intrinsically a bad thing. I think that DRM is basically a clever application of privacy technology. Now, you may not like the way that application is being done by the recording industry or by the video industry, but fundamentally, the mechanisms they're using are appear to be the same mechanisms that can guarantee your privacy within reason. And it's hard to know how to achieve one technically without achieving the other. Now, this, you should understand, is a completely separate discussion from what recording industry lobbyists are doing in Washington. That's a political issue, not a technical issue. On that, I have a very strong opinion, and I think what they've done is they've overthrown a major portion of the Constitution, and I think it's wrong, deeply wrong. That's not a technical issue. All right, so what's the idea? Mostly,
there are two interesting pieces in this kind of hardware. And the history here is that there was a group called the Trusted Computing Alliance, which later morphed into the Trusted Computing Group. They came up with one hardware specification, and if memory serves me, that got labeled TCPA for Trusted Computing Platform. The Trusted Platform Module. Microsoft separately came up with a design, and these two things have now more or less merged. Okay, so there sort of were two prototypical designs floating around. The TPM modules have actually deployed. They exist at least in laptops by IBM. In fact, all of the later business class laptops from IBM are shipping with them. I guess now that would be Lenovo. They exist in several of the business targeted machines that are being shipped by Hewlett-Packard. They conspicuously do not exist in any machine I know about that's being targeted to consumers. And this is kind of funny because the story that was used to promote this stuff was digital rights management, and the major advocate was the music industry, and yet none of the boxes that support this hardware are going to consumers. So, you know, and most people at work don't spend an awful lot of time listening to music unless they happen to work in the recording industry, in which case we're in a different scenario. So, you know, this very emotional issue is kind of funny. So the two functions that are supported by this chipset that are of interest to us, I guess actually there are three. So there's a high-quality random number generator. Turns out good random number generation is really, really hard to do. There are a number of papers on how to do it, and essentially it involves discovering sources of randomness in a machine that the designers were trying to make, you know, as deterministic as they could. And so Linux, for example, collects bits of entropy at various points in the kernel that are used to support dev random, and getting the collection of those bits more or less right turned out to be quite a difficult thing. So having a good random number generator is just generically a useful thing to have. It doesn't add substantively to the power of the computer you've got. What it does maybe do is let you generate keys a little faster. It turns out if you use the key generation mechanisms that are provided in OpenSSL or pick your favorite library, there are sort of two limiting factors. One is just it's a complex operation. Turns out that's not the first limiting factor. The first limiting factor is you have a limited supply of random bits in a machine, and it's not unusual for SSL in the course of reading dev random to actually block while the machine comes up with more random bits. And there are various mechanisms used to sort of extend the random bits that you've got using cryptographic hashes, and you'd really rather have random bits. So that's the first thing, and that's pretty much all I have to say on that subject, except that the reason the chip has this mechanism is it has the ability to generate keys. The second function is attestation, and I'm going to come back to that last. And the third function is secure storage. Very limited supply of secure storage, which is built on top of the attestation mechanism. So what's the motivation for having this chip, other than some desire to do a more efficient local encryption, which turns out the chip does not provide? Motivation mainly is the following scenario. Right? When I have a client and it's talking to some service over a wire, and the service wants to know what contracts of behavior from the client the service has a reasonable expectation of being able to rely on. So, since the client is controlled by its software, at some level what we want to know is what software is running on the client. And we want to know this both at the level, and ultimately we want to know this at the level of, well, if I'm the server, what client application or applications am I talking to? But of course, knowing that isn't very helpful unless I know something about the environment in which those applications run. So there's a bootstrap of a chain of trust that has to be done. And the way this bootstrap works, basically, is if you think about what happens when the machine powers on, right? There's a sequence of bits of code that are executed, right? So the first is the motherboard BIOS, okay? And as part of that, there are bits of various card BIOS code that are executed. Each of these has its chance to set up the initial state of the machine in some fashion, okay? And following these, there's a boot sector. Okay, and then there's a second stage boot because the boot sector actually isn't big enough to do anything useful. There may actually be a couple of second stage boots. Following this, there's the kernel which gets run, and possibly state which the kernel is going to rely on. And I don't think this is the view of this hardware that's being taken by the people promoting it. But my take is, look, it's not our goal to build non-secure systems. If we're going to build non-secure systems, there are lots of existing systems we can run, or non-robust systems. So, in fact, the goal is to get to the place where I know the contract implemented by your kernel. Because here's the deal. If I don't trust the kernel on the other side, right, all further bets are off. So it really doesn't matter what happens after that stage. Conversely, if I do trust the kernel on the other side of the wire, then in particular, I can trust that kernel to make progressively higher certifications about what it's running. So, the question is, how do I know what kernel's running so that I know whether I can believe it? And for kernel, we might take it more broadly that we mean the trusted computing base. I'm actually being very particular here when I say kernel. I really don't mean the rest of the trusted computing base. I'm going to show how to bootstrap that. So here's what the hardware does. And this hardware on these machines is something that the user has to enable. And it's something also that the user can reset. So you can turn it off. There's a catch that you can turn it off. Basically, the card comes up, and it computes a cryptographic checksum of the main board BIOS. Okay. So we know at step one what BIOS is being run on the main board. But that BIOS has been modified so that before it runs the various BIOSes of the attached cards, it accumulates cryptographic checksums for those. And the TPM hardware has a limited supply of cryptographic checksum registers that it can use to store these results temporarily. Having done the cryptographic checksums of those BIOSes, the main BIOS now loads the boot sector and checksums that, and proceeds then to checksum the second stage boot until finally, with the support of the second stage boot, which is going to continue to run these checksums, the second stage boot is going to load the kernel, and having loaded the kernel before branching to it, is going to compute a cryptographic checksum of the kernel. Okay. So when this is all over, what we're going to get here is a sequence of checksums having the following problem. The first one was computed by the TPM chip. That was the one for the BIOS. Main board BIOS. The others were then computed by the main board BIOS or by comparable components. So, assuming that I think your main board BIOS is correctly implemented, and given that I know that you're running that main board BIOS, right, I can mostly rely on the idea that the main board BIOS is then going to compute progressively further checksums in the series in a way that is robust. So here's how this, so here's the idea. If I'm the remote party, and I want to know what kernel you're writing, right? There are basically two questions I need to know the answer to. And by the way, I may not even care about the board BIOSes depending on the kernel, because the kernel may just come up and take over the machine. And I might choose to say, well, I know that this kernel has that property, and so I'm going to ignore the board BIOS issues. But basically, I've got a list of these checksums, the first of which is the main board BIOS, the last of which is the checksum of the kernel. So I'm now in a position to go, and assuming I can build a communication path, and we haven't gotten how to do that yet, I can issue a query to software on this machine, and I can say, tell me what the kernel checksum was. In fact, tell me what this whole sequence of checksums was. And convince me that I should believe you. You don't have to answer that query. But if you want to answer that query, what you do is you turn to the TPM chip and say, which has to have been enabled, and say, ah, you're now holding a pile of checksums. What I want is a signed message signed by the TPM chip confirming that these checksums were in fact computed by the TPM chip. So, inside the TPM chip, there is a secret key that is generated at the chip. Sorry, I'm skipping a step. There's actually a master key. And I'm not entirely clear on how the bootstrapping of this works. There's probably a better mechanism than the one I'm going to describe. But the idea is, this is a secret key that's known to the vendor of the TPM chip, not to you. But by secret key, what I mean is a secret signing key. Okay. The corresponding master checking key is publicly known. What happens when you activate the TPM chip? The TPM chip generates internally a local master key pair. This is the set of keys that it's going to use for local operations. And it reveals the local master checking key. So it can sign, you can check. But this sequence of bits, and I don't actually know if it's the sequence of bits or if it's digital fingerprint of the sequence of bits, it doesn't really matter. Is signed by the master key. Now, what this means is, I can hand you a checking key, right? This is the signature validation key. It's unique to my machine. thinking is encapsulated inside a message, which is signed. So you're able to verify that this checking key was actually generated by a TPM chip. Why? Because the TPM chip has signed it using a key that is not made available for any other purpose. So in order for me to forge this message, I either have to have compromised it at the factory, or I have to have compromised the chip, which is not beyond the realm of possibility. Costs probably about $10,000 to do for the first or second generation of these chips.
What about message replay, though?
What about message replay?
Yeah.
We're not really concerned about message replay yet. Because so far, all I'm trying to get out of this is master checking key, right? And it's okay to replay that. Okay? Later, we're going to have to worry about replay, I agree. Yeah?
This key pair is regenerated for each repo?
No. This local master key is stored in the TPM. Okay. Until the TPM is cleared. And there is a mechanism to reset the TPM, and then this will be cleared. And I'm skipping a step because there actually are two local master key pairs generated, as I understand the design, and I'm not sure that I fully do. One of them is used for signing purposes, and the other is used for local cryptography. Now,
I assume that the reason you have a master key here is because that these are things that are similar from TPM to TPM.
Which things are similar from
the master?
Wait, we're talking the local master or the overall master?
Overall master is there are a few of these, possibly one per series of chips.
My expectation is there's one per TPM vendor. Right. I mean, this real master key, this top level master key, this is the one that protects the entire TPM scheme. Right. Its purpose is, well, realistically, I imagine that if this actually got implemented correctly, we wouldn't really use one universal master key. We'd probably use a bunch of them. So just like if you get a VeriSign today, right? VeriSign has a master VeriSign key, right? That's like the crown jewels. If this thing ever leaks, VeriSign's over, okay? And from this, they generate a bunch of certificate signing keys, okay? And the certificate signing keys are then used to sign a request that you might make to VeriSign to get a website key or something like this. Okay, so there actually is a two-stage remove in the signing chain. Okay, and the general idea is those master signing keys are very, 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 very big. Right, and they can be rotated, and they're used to sign the actual day-to-day working signing keys. Okay. And I imagine, actually, if we were going to do this seriously, we'd probably use a scheme like that, and I don't know if the actual TPM implementation does. And if anybody here knows this better than I do, please feel free to jump in. All right. So now the chip, notice, has the ability to generate signed messages. And I can validate that those came from the chip externally. It also has in its paws these cryptographic checksums. Okay. And if it were willing to sign a message with these cryptographic checksums, where the content of the message was the checksum, and then I could check the signature of this message, then except for a replay, we would at least know that at one time the machine had booted this operating system, and because this checksum got generated, right? And now we'll have to deal with replay. And the solution to replay is actually very straightforward. That when I send you a request saying, prove to me that you're running a certain, tell me what OS you're running, is actually the nature of the query. More realistically, tell me what checksum was generated as you booted. Right? Part of that is I will send you a nonce, which is a one-time use number, which is also going to get bundled into that message. So the message is going to come back to me
right, is going to be convolved by content that I provide. And that's what really, it's a challenge response protocol, and that's where the replay gets, within reason, prevented. So now I have a checksum. I'm now the server, speaking from server perspective. Now I have a checksum. And the intent in this sort of challenge response protocol is to say, well, I imagine that off on the side, I have a couple of lists. These are the lists of biases that I'm willing to believe, or more precisely, the list of checksums, and the list of kernels that I'm willing to believe, and the list of bootstrap codes that I'm willing to believe. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take this checksum set, and I'm going to go through my list, and I now know what OS you're running, and now I can make a decision about whether that OS implements the contract that I want. And if it doesn't, I may elect not to do further protocol with you. Yeah.
So all these checksums are generated at the computer startup time. What's from stopping like a dynamically loaded kernel module from being put in and putting whatever behavior you want?
Who would have so the question is, why can't I dynamically load a module that would change this? The answer is, who would load it? Mechanically, how are you going to get it loaded? You're going to have to go to the bootstrap code or the kernel.
Right, but hasn't that checksum already been generated, or is it updated every time?
This is regenerated every time the machine boots these checksums.
Right, but aren't there, you know, extensions like Linux where you can?
We haven't gotten to the point where we load extensions.
Okay.
Right, any extension is going to be loaded by this kernel. Okay? Now, by loading that extension, one of two things is going to happen. Either we're going to say we trust the kernel, in which case we trust it not to load the wrong extensions. That's part of the contract.
I see.
And that contract is a kernel-enforced contract at this point. Right? Or we're going to say we don't trust the kernel. Right? Or we're going to see that there were further modifications to the code that have the effect of having changed the checksum, in which case we won't believe it.
Right, but the checksum is only done at startup?
Yes.
So
let me get to the kernel. Then let's deal with what happens next. You're asking a good question. In fact, it's a really important question. All right. There's something else, just to sort of finish out the picture, that happens along the way here. I mentioned that the TPM chip has a limited amount of secure storage. The secure storage is a non-volatile memory. And here's how the protocol works. If the chip is turned on, then a kernel can go to the TPM and say, I would like to allocate some secure storage. And I'd like to store something there. And the intention of the design is that what should be stored there is a cryptographic key that can be used only by this kernel. And basically, the way this works is next time the machine, so when what the TPM stores is a pair, which consists of whatever bits the kernel wanted to store, paired with the checksum of the entity that stored them. And the deal is, you can only read those bits back if the checksum matches. Okay. So if I need some other OS, and it goes to the TPM and says, give me those bits. The TPM is going to say, your checksum doesn't match. I won't disclose those bits to you.
Is that checksum of the kernel or entire checksum stack?
My belief is it's the entire checksum stack.
Okay.
In fact, the answer is I don't know the details, but I know they put a lot of care into this. My guess is either it's the entire checksum stack or there's a good rationale for why it doesn't matter.
Okay.
And there's more to the story because the TPM has a very limited amount of storage, so actually there's a bit of bootstrapping stuff that has to happen here because what you really want is to store some potentially large number of keys, and the TPM really doesn't have enough storage to do that on board
So there's a mechanism for a designed mechanism for storing a tree of these keys. But the upshot of it is that my kernel can get back a cryptographic key that's not accessible to any other kernel. And the idea here is this means that I could use this key to do disk encryption, and next time I boot up, I can decrypt the disk. Now there's one other piece to the protocol, which is there is a mechanism to say, and I want to make this key available to some other checksum. So in particular, the problem is when I upgrade the kernel, its checksum is going to change. If its checksum changes, then the TPM will not agree to give the key out to the successor kernel. So there is a handoff protocol in the TPM that basically lets you graduate the key to the next kernel so that you can preserve access to the disk across upgrades. That you can see, this might be delicate, okay? Right. This is a really, really good chance to turn your 100 gigabyte disk into an empty drive if you get this right. But something else is true. Not only can the kernel use that key to encrypt the disk, but the kernel can use that key to encrypt other information known to the kernel. In particular, the kernel could use that key to encrypt a kernel signing key. So we can extend this chain out. Basically, once we get a trustworthy kernel booted, that kernel can now do the same kind of a layered protocol for anything else. Now, going back to your question about loading other stuff. Look, the reason we would trust this kernel is we have reason to know, to believe, that it enforces isolation successfully. So we are, in fact, as the remote party, once we say we trust this kernel, part of what we're saying is that's not interesting unless we can trust and use certain kinds of non-interference properties for us. So the goal is to sort of provide enough mechanism that I can remotely bootstrap this chain of trust. Why is this incredibly hard to do? Number one, it's incredibly hard to do because the set of system configurations that I have to do this over is enormous. Every time I do a driver change, I'm changing the state of the target system, particularly in a monolithic kernel. So it turns out to be very, very hard to make this work for monolithic kernels, because every time somebody ships you a driver update, this thing's got to be managed correctly. There's also the problem that potentially there's a large number of kernels in the world and a large number of BIOSes in the world. It's not clear that anybody exists who has the necessary expertise to keep up-to-date lists of which of these checksums are okay. And from the perspective, now setting aside the question of whether you like the recording industry, right, put yourself in the role of the recording industry, your goal is to make it hard for me to steal your content. There's an operational problem that if I were going to rely on this mechanism, there's some very large number of systems that I have to actually be able to support. And now here's an interesting problem. Suppose your system gets cracked. Right, up to this point, I've been willing to send you music, and at some point I discover your BIOS now is discovered to have had a flaw all along. It wasn't previously known. What do I do about it? I mean, do I cut you off from your music source? This does not seem likely to generate positive feelings with customers. Okay. In fact, it appears to be the case that the management of this protocol is so complicated for monolithic kernels that everybody gave up. RIAA is no longer pushing this idea. Microsoft has actually backed off on it for consumer devices substantially. It's probably feasible in handheld devices just because people don't update those very often. It's probably not feasible from a market perspective in desktop. So an interesting question is, why should we care? And here's another possible answer. Suppose that I actually have two systems that are peers. And I want to know, for example, that the system on the other side is running a known OS, because then the OSs can get together and establish a mutual trust environment, right, in which they can engage in certain transactions that they otherwise can't safely engage in. And this is actually the DRM story again, right? The question is, for example, can I expose to you bits that name capabilities that I can then trust coming back from you, right, without fear that you'll go and expose them to a user in a way that would sort of let them hack the kernel protocol? And the answer might be yes, but it depends on what code you're running, and I need to bootstrap that with something. The chip has a mechanism for turning all this stuff off. And what that does is put the chip in a state where, in order to turn it on again, right, you have to do a total reset, at which time the chip will generate a new local master key pair. Don't turn this off with your disk content still encrypted. That would be double plus ungood. So an interesting problem with this design from a corporate perspective: how do I do data retrieval, right? Some guy at my company has just ripped off my database, right? He's shipped it to somebody, and I've just fired this son of a bitch, right? And he's handed me back his laptop, but managed to have enough time to reset the TPM chip. I now can't do forensics on this laptop to find out what he had run. I can't even look at his home record. Well, you can imagine designs that would allow us to do that if we were doing a corporate build of an OS. But the thing is, you got to think this stuff through in advance, because if you blow it, there's no recovery with an acceptable cost. I personally have lost disks to physical mishap, okay? And people don't back these things up, right? I mean, you know, cryptography is just one more way to have a total disk failure, as far as I can tell in this application. You know, on the other hand, if I were carrying a laptop through environments where I expected that it might be lifted by somebody, I might care. And there are companies that are concerned about that. On-disk encryption is becoming a hot commodity. Okay, so questions about this?
I just thought that this might be a problem. So even if you have a microkernel, and if you are a kernel hacker, you are in the habit of modifying your own kernel code and running it. It may be a problem because the server won't have a checksum for your version of the kernel.
That's correct. In fact, the whole point is the server only wants to engage with you when it knows what you're doing. If you've modified the kernel, it doesn't know what you're doing. Now, that's not to say you can't modify the kernel. You can. Right, if you're running a modified kernel, you've broken your contract with me. There's no reason for me to believe you anymore. Now, that's got pros and cons, right? So let me give an example of an application of this that I actually want. Okay, and it showed up in USA Today, a variant of it showed up in USA Today not very long ago, just last week. There's a lovely article. Some guy logs in over the USA Today website, over the Bank of America website, to examine the status of his business banking account. Now, I'm a Bank of America business customer, and when I signed up for my account, they said, oh, we have all these lovely online services. Wouldn't you like to sign up for those too? And having a little bit of experience with these things, I said, oh, can I do electronic check writing with these services? They said, of course. I said, if you turn it on, I'll kill you. Okay? Because what that means is, anybody with my 4-digit PIN can log in over the web and write a check to themselves. This is wonderful. Definitely something I want attached to my business bank account, right? So this guy logs in, and he's actually there in time to see somebody transfer $90,000 out of his account, which is most of what he's got. He calls the bank, and they basically throw up their hands and say, sorry, protection of your password was your responsibility. It's not on us. You're not a consumer. Consumers have protections that businesses don't. Well, how was his password stolen? Turns out his password was stolen by a Trojan horse that was installed by a virus, and basically the attacker had keyboard sniffed him to get his password. And B of A is now in the newspaper saying, look, it's not our responsibility. There's nothing we could have done. And the only problem with this statement is I actually had a discussion with their head of security for this function explaining that what they needed to do was turn this feature off so that exactly this couldn't be done. We'll see what happens with the lawsuit. One of the things I'd like to be able to do if I'm going to do online banking is I'd like to cut a deal with the bank that says, look, if the order doesn't come from my machine, and we can do that without doing OS attestation. We can just do unique ID on the TPM chip or on the processor. If the order doesn't come from my machine, I don't care if I sign it. It's not authorized. Right? I don't care if it came with my PIN. I don't want to do banking on the road, thank you. Or if I do, I'm going to lug a machine. And there are now banks that are using so-called secure ID systems where you're constantly changing random knots and you have to key it, you know, within the 1 minute that it's good. Banks are reluctant to do this because my grandmother's not dead, so she doesn't worry about this much. My father will never figure out how to use one of those devices. Now, the truth is my father will never figure out how to use online banking either, so this is not really a big threat. But my mother might figure both of these things out. And the banks say, well, we don't want to make online banking inconvenient. Why not? Because if online banking is inconvenient, they actually have to pay for those things called tellers that they used to have. So there are applications of this technology. Local encryption, right? Secure federation, at least increasing the challenge to insecure banking. There are a variety of applications like that where I think I personally would want this technology available to me. And none of that really, most of that doesn't really sit on building this whole chain of trust. So, other questions about this? I mean, you're absolutely right. If I modify my kernel, right, bets are off. And there are people in the open source community who right now are quite upset about that. I mean, one way to look at it is they want to preserve the right to modify what's on my system if I'm the owner. Right? But, and I think that's a fine thing to do. This doesn't stand in the way of that. Right? And that's very subtle, right? What this stands in the way of is lying about whether you did it. Right? Doesn't require you to generate an answer. But if you generate an answer, very hard to spoof. Now, okay, very quickly, how can I beat this, right? There's always a price. Mechanisms like this always have a cost of defeat. Okay? If I'm in a position to put probes on the busted machine and I have to know how to do so, you know, pretty much all bets are off. Right? We've already talked about some memory failure modes that can cause random unspecified behavior, right? Because particle hits on memory. The next generation of this stuff has additional features for what they call curtaining. Curtaining is a form of memory partitioning. And what's going on is Microsoft concluded that they didn't know how to do this to actually pull this off for something the size of Windows. They said, oh, what we'll do a microkernel inside Windows, which is the Palladium effort, and we'll basically put hardware enforcement in that separates the microkernel from the surrounding Windows, and you can go ahead and run all your Windows crap, and we'll do all the sensitive stuff inside this microkernel that's protected by hardware. And even that is turning out to be a great challenge to pull off. So sorry, there was a question. Yeah.
Does this support any type of, hibernation? Like where you shut your machine down, but just saving all your RAM state to hard drive and coming back up?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The answer is I don't know.
Because I mean, I can foresee that you hibernate, pull the drive out, play with some bits on another computer, go back, you've changed your in RAM state essentially, but in theory all of your...
It's a really good question, and the answer is I don't know. Yeah, put it this way. I know that the way that we do checkpointing in Eros would survive that attack because we do actually reboot the kernel and then reload the checkpointer. But conventional hibernation technology, the answer is I don't know. And I can imagine a couple of possible ways to resolve that. mostly checksum in the memory image on the way out and on the way back. And the thing is, you have a, it's not that hard to do that, but I don't know if they thought about it. I haven't looked. There's a lot of, the thing to understand is that while this hardware is out there, the only working examples of how to use it are small configurations that run only in laboratories. And so I suspect that a lot of these issues have been identified as to be solved someday. But I don't know that, that one in particular is actually pretty obvious, and I'm sure people thought about it. But, and I can imagine a couple of ways to beat it, but I don't know that anything's been published. I mean, to ensure safety across that, but I don't know that anything's been published. An interesting problem with that is when I restore that image, right, I also need to restore the register state of the TPM chip. And the whole point of the register state of the TPM chip is there ain't no way to restore it without rerunning the checksum, right? So there's an interesting delicacy in that particular problem. Other questions?
I mean, if you could probe your bus, and I don't know how difficult to reach that is, isn't it sort of just a matter of, you know, effort and a soldering iron to you know, feed this trusted chip whatever you want to create all the proper materials and signatures?
The answer is yes. Correct. I mean, the question is always, how much will it cost? In fact, I don't think the threat model is people feeding things to the chip. Okay. I think the threat model is, I mean, that might happen, but I'm not greatly worried about it. The threat model is, I have some content, I do a negotiation with your machine, I get to the point where I say, your machine's okay. I send you some stuff whose protection I care about, right? And now you just scan this stuff out of memory, right? The problem with encryption is I only have to read the clear text once, right? And it doesn't matter how many clever keys I got. Okay. Now, there are system designs where we have tamper-proofing technologies, or excuse me, tamper-resist technologies, that can make that quite expensive. But there are no known perfect solutions to these kinds of problems, right? They're only levels of effort. So what I, as a sender of sensitive information, can do is say, look, I know the cost of the attack is X, right? I know the cost of just paying for the information is Y. And I know that the recurring benefit, if you crack it, you know, I can design my system so it has some limit. And now, so now what we have is a negotiability of threat. And at some point, I conclude that the threat likelihood is low enough that I can take the risk. And often I can provide temporal scoping on the threat as well. So yeah, I may lose one song, but I may not lose the next one. Right? Or in the bank transaction case, I've got a nonce in the picture. Yep, you can snoop the nonce, but the nonce is only good for one transaction, and at that only for the next 5 minutes. No perfect solutions to any of this. The next version of this is a lot stronger. The big issue is tamper resist. That's incredibly expensive, and we're not going to see it on commodity machines anytime soon. But variants of this technology are showing up in the PlayStation and the Xbox and that crowd, right? And those versions just won't boot anything that doesn't check signature. And the solution to that is to hack the font files. But the way people loaded Linux on the PlayStations was by exploiting an error in the font rendering software. Well, was that the Xbox?
Sony explicitly allows you to run Linux.
Okay, right. So, so there's a problem, right? The choice is being curtailed, and there are users who really don't like that. My guess is a lot of users are much more worried about protection than they are about loss of choice, because they're planning to run Windows anyway. So, all right, let's call it a day with this.